Hello, check, check, test, test. Sounds like we got liftoff here.
Okay. All right. Are we doing the verse? We should do the verse. Okay. May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering step this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. So good evening, friends. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Genko. I'm one of the teachers here. I don't know quite a few of you because I haven't been showing up on Wednesday nights very much. And so I'm pleased and impressed to see this many people here in the hall and a good representative of folks on Zoom as well. So what we're doing this term, actually for the rest of the year until the end of May, is sutra studies. And this is something we started doing last year sometime on Sundays once a month. And just sort of giving the teachers each, you know, we get to each pick something that makes sense to us, that's meaningful to us, to present to the rest of the world. And we decided to bring it to Wednesday nights because quite a few people are interested, I think, in the sutras, and we don't really have like a good way to study those other than in the seminary program, which is sort of a different kind of a deal. So here's what we're doing. When we did this before, let's see. Oh, here it is. When we did this before, it turned out that for three months in a row, three different teachers had kind of some similar areas in terms of what we had decided to choose, which from the Pali Canon. So the other two previous ones were the Anapanasati Sata Sutra, and those have to do with mindfulness of breathing. And then this is from the Satipatthana Sutra, which is the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And the Four Foundations of Mindfulness show up in this other sutra in a bunch of different ways. And so, but I realized when I was hearing them talk about it that it had a different approach. It was kind of and a different kind of emphasis than the way that I have been working with this. So I thought, well, this is still worth presenting. And so this is what I'm going to do tonight. So this particular sutra, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it's pretty short. I wanted to read the whole thing, but of course it's, you know, it's really too long. What I'm going to do is I'm focusing on this book, Transformation and Healing by Thich Nhat Hanh, and where he talks basically about this. He calls it the Four Establishments of Mindfulness. Different translation is all. And I'm gonna end up using a fair amount of repetition, which is a hallmark of the Pali Canon. It's based on an oral tradition where there was a lot of repetition and a lot of sort of ways of saying the same thing over and over in some different ways. So I'm gonna do a certain amount of that. By the end of this evening, you should be very clear on what these four foundations of mindfulness are, because I'm going to talk about them from a couple of different, two or three different perspectives. So, I read a little bit from this introduction. So Thich Nhat Hanh starts with, what is mindfulness? And those of you who've had any exposure to Thich Nhat Hanh know that mindfulness is sort of his big deal. We practice mindfulness in order to realize liberation, peace, and joy in our everyday lives. Liberation and happiness are linked to each other. If there is liberation, there is happiness, and greater liberation brings greater happiness. If there is liberation, peace and joy exist in the present moment. We don't need to wait 10 or 15 years to realize them. They're available as soon as we begin the practice. However modest these elements may be, they form the basis for greater liberation, peace, and joy in the future. To practice meditation is to look deeply in order to see into the essence of things. With insight and understanding, we can realize liberation, peace, and joy. Our anger, anxiety, and fear are the ropes that bind us to suffering. If we want to be liberated from them, we need to observe their nature, which is ignorance, the lack of clear understanding, and so on. We'll read the rest of that. I wanted to read a little bit from the very beginning of the sutra. Oh, no, this is, let's see, wait a second here. Yes, the beginning of it. Yes, here we go. So that you get a bit of a flavor of it. And in any case, the first section is an introduction to it, and it summarizes it in its own way. So this is how it goes. I heard these words of the Buddha. One time when he was living at Kamasadharma, a market town of the Kuru people, the Buddha addressed the bhikkhus. O bhikkhus, and the bhikkhus replied, Venerable Lord. The Buddha said, Bhikkhus, there is a most wonderful way to help living beings realize purification, overcome directly grief and sorrow, end pain and anxiety, travel the right path, and realize nirvana. This way is the four establishments of mindfulness. What are the four establishments? One, bhikkhus, a practitioner remains established in the observation of the body in the body, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. Two, he remains established in the observation of the feelings in the feelings, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. Three, he remains established in the observation of the mind in the mind, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. Four, he remains established in the observation of the objects of mind, in the objects of mind, diligent, with clear understanding, mindful, having abandoned every craving and every distaste for this life. That's section one. Section two begins, and how does a practitioner remain established in the observation of the body in the body? He goes to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty room, sits down cross-legged in the lotus position, holds his body straight, and establishes mindfulness in front of him. He breathes in, aware that he is breathing in. He breathes out, aware that he is breathing out. When he breathes in a long breath, he knows, I am breathing in a long breath. When he breathes out a long breath, he knows, I am breathing out a long breath. When he breathes in a short breath, he knows, I am breathing in a short breath. When he breathes out a short breath, he knows, I am breathing out a short breath. He uses the following practice. Breathing in, I am aware of my whole body. Breathing out, I am aware of my whole body. And then, breathing in, I calm my body. Breathing out, I calm my body. And then it goes on. And obviously, it'll have a section on each one of the four foundations. So then Thich Nhat Hanh has a quick little summary of the sutra, which I will read some of, maybe all of it, most of. So, the four methods of mindfulness described in the sutra are, one, mindfulness of the body. Two, mindfulness of feelings. Three, mindfulness of the mind. And four, mindfulness of the objects of mind. Okay, so there's another repetition of the four foundations. You'll hear them more times. In the establishment known as the body, the practitioner is fully aware of the breath, the positions of the body, the actions of the body, the various parts of the body, the four elements which comprise the body, and the decomposition of the body as a corpse. In the establishment known as the feelings, the practitioner is fully aware of pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings as they arise, endure, and disappear. He is aware of feelings that have a psychological basis, and feelings that have a physiological basis. In the establishment known as the mind, the practitioner is fully aware of states of mind, such as desire, hatred, confusion, concentration, dispersion, internal formations, and liberation. In the establishment known as the objects of mind, the practitioner is fully aware of the five aggregates that comprise a person, also known as the skandhas, form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. The sense organs and their objects, the factors that can obstruct understanding and liberation, the factors that can lead to awakening, and the Four Noble Truths concerning suffering and the release from suffering. In other words, we have a whole lot of Buddhist teachings in this one little sutra. So, as I mentioned, the sutra is divided into six sections. Section one describes the circumstances under which the sutra was delivered and the importance of the teachings of the sutra, and it lists the four establishments of mindfulness. Section two describes the method of mindfulness of the body in the body. Section three describes the method of mindfulness of the feelings in the feelings. Section four describes the method of mindfulness of the mind in the mind. Section five describes the method of mindfulness in the objects of mind, in the objects of mind. And section six describes the fruits of the practice and the length of time needed in order to realize these fruits. I got there and I was like, wait a minute, what is that? How long does it take? Whoa. So section six starts out, Bhikkhus, he who practices the four establishments of mindfulness for 7 years can expect one of two fruits, the highest understanding in this very life, or if there remains some residue of affliction, he can attain the fruit of no return. Okay? But it goes on. Let alone 7 years, Bhikkhus, whoever practices in the four establishments of mindfulness for 6, 5, 4, 3, 2 years, or 1 year can also expect one of two fruits, either the highest understanding in this very life, or if there remains some residue of affliction, he can attain the fruit of no return. Okay, so that gives you a little break from your 7 years. Okay, let alone 1 year, whoever practices in the four establishments of mindfulness for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, or 2 months, 1 month, or half a month can also expect, can you believe it? Two fruits, the same two fruits, okay? And then let alone half a month, whoever practices the four establishments of mindfulness for 1 week can also expect one of two fruits. And I guess that's as far as we go. You have to at least do a week. Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. So, this is why we said that this path, the path of the four grounds for the establishment of mindfulness, is the most wonderful path, which helps beings realize purification, transcend grief and sorrow, destroy pain and anxiety, travel the right path, and realize nirvana. The bhikkhus were delighted to hear the teaching of the Buddha. They took it to heart and began to put it in practice. Okay, so that gives you an overview of the sutra and how it's laid out. There's a couple of things I want to do in here. There, he has some exercises in this book. Let's see. Yeah, and I thought we might try these just to see what you how you think you might do with this. Could you bring me a bell? I wanted to just try a minute of this and just see how people do with it. Yeah. Good, you picked the little bell instead of the big bell. Thank you. I'll put it over here. All right, so here's the first one called conscious breathing. And this is about, this is under talking about mindfulness of the body. So it's just called conscious breathing. So quoting from the sutra, He goes to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty room, sits down one-legged, or cross-legged in the, one-legged. That's not what I intended at all. Sits down cross-legged in the lotus position, holds his body straight, and establishes mindfulness in front of him. He breathes in, aware that he is breathing in. He breathes out, aware that he is breathing out. So, this first practice is the full awareness of breathing. When we breathe in, we know we are breathing in. When we breathe out, we know that we are breathing out. Practicing in this way, our breathing becomes conscious breathing. This exercise is simple, yet its effects are profound. To succeed, we must put our whole mind into our breathing and nowhere else. So let's try this for 1 minute and see how you do. Notice how it goes for you. And I will ring the bell at the beginning and at the end. Okay, how'd you do? We can get the handheld for people want to kind of report in a little bit on how that went for them. Yeah, here's one over here. So what we've been doing on Sunday mornings is that whenever you say something, you start with your name so that all of us can get a sense of who you are.
I'm Sage. It worked for... a few breaths. Uh-huh. And I was like, this is great. And then I started thinking about how great it is.
Uh-huh. Right.
Right. That's it.
So simple, but not easy, right? Okay. Anybody else? It's over here. Yeah. Go on.
And if you're on Zoom, you are free to unmute yourself.
I'm Kakuon, and yeah, basically the same, like with an added flavor of like, oh, I know how to do this. Like, I'm familiar with Zazen Yojinki. Like, I can think about my nostrils. Oh.
Right? Okay, anybody else? Did anyone like feel like they really managed to stay with it the entire minute? Yeah, we've got one back here. We've got a couple over here. Yeah, we've got a few people in the room who felt like they did all right with that. I'll have to say, I'm no good at this. So, and of course, I'm also keeping time. So that was my excuse. That was my out on this one. Okay. So let's see. I think... I will read the rest of what his commentary on this one is, and we'll do one more. As we follow our in-breath, for example, we may need to watch for distracting thoughts. As soon as a thought like, I forgot to turn off the light in the kitchen, arises, our breathing is no longer conscious breathing, as we are thinking about something else. To succeed, our mind needs to stay focused on our breathing for the entire length of each breath. As we breathe, our mind is one with our breath, and we become one with our breath. That is the meaning of mindfulness of the body in the body. I just want to mention that Hogan uses the phrase, feel the body, or be aware of the body with the body. So use the body to be aware of the body, which I kind of like as a way of really making it clear that it's not about thinking about the body, right? It's this really awareness that's grounded in the body. Anyone can succeed in the practice of a single conscious breath. If we continue to breathe consciously for 10 breaths without our mind going astray, then we have taken a valuable step on the path of practice. If we can practice conscious breathing for 10 minutes, an important change will take place in us. How can a practice as simple as this bring about such important results? And what are the results that it can bring about? The first result of conscious breathing is returning to ourselves. In everyday life, we are often lost in forgetfulness. Our mind chases after thousands of things, and we rarely take the time to come back to ourselves. When we have been lost in forgetfulness like that for a long time, we lose touch with ourselves, and we feel alienated from ourselves. So now we're going to look to the second exercise. I'm going to just skip over some of this. Following the breath. Sounds pretty similar. Here's quoting from the sutra again. When he breathes in a long breath, he knows I am breathing in a long breath. When he breathes out a long breath, he knows I am breathing out a long breath. When he breathes in a short breath, he knows I am breathing in a short breath. When he breathes out a short breath, he knows I am breathing out a short breath. So in this case, the practitioner is following their breathing very closely and becoming one with the breathing for the entire length of the breath, not allowing any stray thought or idea to enter. So, I'll read the rest of this. This method is called following the breath. While the mind is following the mind is the breath. And only the breath. In the process of this practice, our breathing naturally becomes more regular, harmonious, and calm, and our mind also becomes more regular, harmonious, and calm. This brings about feelings of joy, peace, and ease in the body. When the mind and the breathing become one, it is only a step for the mind and body to become one also. So let's try this again. Thinking about the long and the short, and just staying right with the breath. And once again, we'll just do a minute, see if anything has changed. Okay. Did that go any better? Oh, I'm seeing nods. Okay. Oh, good. A little bit of a yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got a comment over here.
Hi, my name is Gail. That did go better, but I'm not sure what I did differently. It did go better, but I was like, what's the nuance in the difference between conscious, the first exercise and the second exercise? So it's, I'm just curious.
Yeah. I think part of it is that, you know, we talked about it, so it kind of helped us get a sense of what we're doing and why we're doing it a little more, and really helped us focus in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Also, it's just practice. You know, a lot of this is practice.
That's a bit,
what's your name?
Kelsey, by the way. Kelsey.
Okay.
So a bit hard to describe exactly, but I think in the last exercise, I was focused on each breath as a unit. Uh-huh. And I found that after the breath has gone, my mind lingered on the breath that had just passed. And I realized that I was no longer focusing on breathing. I was focusing on the breath.
What just
happened? Like, what a great breath that was. You know, I just, you know, I was living in the previous breath. But as I break it down to, instead of focusing on the line, just being on the points on the line, then I kind of lost track of the beginning and the start of each breath and was simply there as all along.
Well,
it was
great.
A different sensation.
Yeah, yeah. I found that I was, in my timekeeping, the first time I was about 30 seconds when I looked at my watch to see where we were. This time I had gone for a whole minute before I looked at the watch, and I sort of went, oh, we're there. Okay. So, so yeah, practice, I guess, as much as anything. And we have another one behind you.
My name's Jay. I usually, when I begin sitting, I go through these as a process. I find I have to start by counting. And counting is more, has that feeling of just, you just start to count, and then pretty soon the counting falls into the background, and then I'll know, let's switch and think in and out. And that to me feels like touching somebody on the shoulder. You just, it's a touch, and you know that you're doing it. When I switch to doing this, following in and out, it feels more like the breath equivalent of a caress to me. And as soon as I start doing that just a little bit, everything seems to really change for me. Just the quality of my sitting suddenly settles in, and I know, but it takes me those steps of going through this to kind of get there.
Yeah, there's a process that goes on there sometimes. Okay, and then back over behind, over here.
I'm Ryan. I was struck by the contrast between the short breaths and the long breaths, and it got me to, I want to say thinking, but it was really about sensing other ways to know the breath. You know, the increased capacity, or the movement of my torso, and also the sound. And then I was struck by the sound of the water outside. And so I'm wondering, these sensations, and then also when you mentioned the caress, you made me think of the touch, that the sensations are a way to hone in on the breath, and are not a distraction, but are an element of the breath.
Yes. Right. When you're working with sensation, you are automatically right here in the body. So that's a great way to look at it. For me, when I've had trouble with the breath, it's very easy for me to be abstract about it and sort of discursive about it. So the counting doesn't work very well for me. And even the long and short, I was starting to feel like, well, that's just comparing. So I have to be careful with that. So I just had to feel long and feel short and feel like, okay, this one's it's not as deep, but not trying to get the words out of there as much as I can, and just sort of feel what that feels like. So yeah, there's a lot of traps there. Okay. Well, let's move on a little bit. I want to switch gears here, and some of this will be a little bit repetitious as well. This is from an article, which is an excerpt from Bhante Gunaratana's book, Four Foundations of Mindfulness in Plain English. He's a Theravadan teacher. And this was, let's see, I think this was in, I've got two articles here, so I'm not quite sure where this one appeared, where this excerpt appeared. But anyway, this is another way to think about or to approach this same sutra. Mindfulness practice has deep roots in the Buddhist tradition. More than 2,600 years ago, the Buddha exhorted his senior bhikkhus, monks with the responsibility of passing his teachings on to others, to train their students in the four foundations of mindfulness. What for? He was asked. Come, friends, the Buddha answered. Dwell, contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, unified with concentrated, one-pointed mind, in order to know the body as it really is. Dwell, contemplating feeling in the feelings, in order to know feelings as they really are. Dwell, contemplating mind in mind, and there's asterisk where all this is repetition has been left out, in order to know mind as it really is. Dwell, contemplating dharma in dharmas, in order to know dharmas as they really are. So this should sound sort of familiar. It's a different translation, but it's the same information from the sutra. He goes on to say, the practice of contemplating, or we might say meditating on, the four foundations, mindfulness of body, mind, feelings, mind, and dharmas, or phenomena, is recommended for people at every stage of the spiritual path. As the Buddha goes on to explain, everyone, trainees who have recently become interested in the Buddhist path, monks and nuns, even arhats, advanced meditators who have already reached the goal of liberation from suffering, should be exhorted, settled, and established in the development of these four foundations of mindfulness. In this sutra, the Buddha is primarily addressing the community of bhikkhus, monks, and nuns who have dedicated their lives to spiritual practice. Given this, you might wonder whether people with families and jobs and busy Western lives can benefit from this mindfulness practice. If the Buddha's words were meant only for monastics, he would have given this talk in a monastery or in a monastic setting. But he spoke in a village filled with shopkeepers, farmers, and other ordinary folk. Since mindfulness can help men and women from all walks of life relieve suffering, we can assume that the word bhikkhu is used to mean anyone seriously interested in meditation. And in that sense, we are all bhikkhus. So here's his take on each of these four foundations. So mindfulness of body. By asking us to practice mindfulness of the body, the Buddha is reminding us to see the body in the body. By these words, he means that we should recognize that the body is not a solid, unified thing, but rather a collection of parts. The nails, teeth, skin, bones, heart, lungs, and all other parts, each is actually a small body that is located in the larger entity that we call the body. Traditionally, the human body is divided into 32 parts. Don't ask me what those are. I don't know. 32, that's what it says. And we train ourselves to be mindful of each. Trying to be mindful of the entire body is like trying to grab a heap of oranges. If we grab the whole heap at once, perhaps we will end up with nothing. Moreover, remembering that the body is composed of many parts helps us to see the body as body, not my body or myself, but simply as a physical form like all other physical forms. Like all forms, the body comes into being, remains present for a time, and then passes away. Since it experiences injury, illness, and death, the body is unsatisfactory as a source of lasting happiness. Right? Since it is not myself, the body can also be called selfless. When mindfulness helps us to recognize that the body is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and selfless, in the Buddha's words, we know the body as it really is. Well, that's a little different way of thinking about mindfulness of the body, but some provocative, interesting stuff in there. Okay, mindfulness of feelings. Similarly, by asking us to practice mindfulness of feelings, the Buddha is telling us to contemplate the feeling in the feelings. The feeling in the feelings. Okay? These words remind us that, like the body, feelings can be subdivided. Traditionally, there are only three types: pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, and neutral feelings. Each type is one feeling in the mental awareness of what we call feelings. At any given moment, we are able to notice only one type. When a pleasant feeling is present, neither a painful feeling nor a neutral feeling is present. And the same thing is true of unpleasant or neutral feelings. Now, I'm going to throw in here that when I first encountered this particular thing about there's only three different kinds of feelings, I went, what? And I had a really hard time trying to identify whether it was pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And I realized at some point it's because I suddenly got into thinking about them. You know, the mind gets in there and it starts comparing, but, well, it's pleasant, but, you know, it's also kind of not so great. I mean, you know, you can just like go nuts with that stuff. So trying to get down to a place where I could really identify what is pleasant, what is unpleasant, and what is neutral, and just stick with that when I'm when I'm dealing with feelings. So part of what Buddhist practice does and the teachings do that I have found useful is a lot of what we're doing here is we're sort of picking things apart. So instead of the heap of whole heap of oranges, we're just like looking at one, you know, maybe even just an orange peel. I mean, you know, so that it starts to be a little more manageable and it's not quite so, you know, overwhelming and so on. So recognizing, for me, this has been an incredibly useful teaching for me, this Four Foundations, because one of the useful things for me about it is to really start noticing, here's what's going on in the body. Here's what's going on in feelings. Here's what's going on in the mind. And here's what's actually, you know, in terms of what's the dharmas, the phenomena, what's really out there. The way I think of it is, here's what's really true. That's maybe a little bit not quite what they're getting at, but it works for me. So I wanted to just point that out, that if you're having any trouble with this, you're in good company. So we regard feelings in this way to help us develop a simple, non-judgmental awareness of what we are experiencing. Non-judgmental is a huge part of this, which I will come back to later. Seeing a particular feeling as one of many feelings rather than as my feeling or as part of me. As we watch each emotion or sensation as it arises, remains present, and passes away, we observe that any feeling is impermanent. Since a pleasant feeling does not last, and an unpleasant feeling is often painful, we understand that feelings are unsatisfactory. Seeing a feeling as an emotion or sensation rather than as my feeling, we come to know that feelings are selfless. Recognizing these truths, we know feelings as they really are. Okay, mindfulness of mind. So the same process applies to mindfulness of mind. Although we talk about the mind as if it were a single thing, actually, mind or consciousness is a succession of particular instances of mind in mind. As mindfulness practice teaches us, consciousness arises from moment to moment on the basis of information coming to us from the senses, what we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch, and from internal mental states such as memories, imaginings, and daydreams. When we look at the mind, we are not looking at mere consciousness. The mind alone cannot exist. Only particular states of mind that appear depending on external or internal conditions. Paying attention to the way each thought arises, remains present, and passes away, we learn to stop the runaway train of one unsatisfactory thought leading to another and another and another. We gain a bit of detachment and understand that we are not our thoughts. In the end, we come to know mind as it really is. This has been a huge one for me. I don't know how about you guys, but it's like being able to step back from the mind and watch it instead of feeling that this is me, this is who I am. I'm, you know, this, the, how did that go? You are not your thoughts. Don't believe everything you think. There are some of those kinds of slogans that can be useful for this. And starting to recognize that it's really what's going on, and there is a jumble. And this is one of the things we discover sometimes when we sit down and meditate. You know, we're sort of like, all of a sudden you start paying attention to your mind, and it's like, what the heck is all of that stuff? You know, oh, now I'm over here. Oh, now I'm over here. So there's some tools for working with that. Things like, you know, focusing on the gap between. So sometimes, I loved it. One of our Sangha members talked about, you know, I'm really thinking hard about something going on with my job. And it's like, it's just a big deal. And I'm really focused on that. And then a little while later, I realize, now I'm thinking about something happening in my family. What happened to the job? What happened there? I mean, you know, and if you watch your mind, that's the kind of stuff that goes on. All of a sudden, it's like, wait, I was over. What happened there? Is there a gap maybe between there, or did it lead one thing to another? Or typically, it's all little pieces. And that's the way, you know, what he's saying here. It's this sort of bunch of different things. So when I think of this in terms of the foundations of mindfulness, I think of it as I like to think of being aware of the mind as noticing what the stories are. What's the mind telling me in this moment? And is it true? Right? So these are all talking a lot more about mind states and sort of different ways of being in the mind. For me, stories made more sense to me. It's like, okay, now it's telling me that I'm in danger, or now it's telling me this is great, or it's telling me, you know, this or that or the other thing. And it's based on the kinds of things that he's talked about here, is like on memories and, you know, suppositions and daydreams and imaginations and stuff. And it's not necessarily based on reality. It's just, you know, so when you can step back and start noticing that, you know, you can free yourself from a lot of obstruction. Okay, and finally, we come to mindfulness of dharmas, is the way this person talks about it, is the dharmas or the phenomena. And this is the one that I always say, what's really true, which I don't know if it's any more true than anything else, but at least it's another way to think about it. By telling us to practice mindfulness of dharmas or phenomena, the Buddha is not simply saying that we should be mindful of his teachings, though that is one meaning of the word dharma. He is also reminding us that the Dharma that we contemplate is within us. There we go. The history of the world is full of truth seekers. The Buddha was one of them. Almost all sought the truth outside of themselves. Before he attained enlightenment, the Buddha also searched outside of himself. He was looking for his maker, the cause of his existence, who he called the builder of this house. But he never found what he was looking for. Instead, he discovered that he himself was subject to birth, growth, decay, death, sickness, sorrow, lamentation, and defilement. When he looked outside of himself, he saw that everyone else was suffering from these same problems. This recognition helped him to see that no one outside of himself could free him from his suffering. So he began to search within. The inner seeking is known as come and see. Only when he began to search inside did he find the answer. And then he said, many a birth I wandered in samsara, seeking but not finding the builder of this house. Sorrowful it is to be born again and again. O house builder, thou art seen. Thou shalt not build house again. All thy rafters are broken. Thy ridgepole is shattered. The mind has attained the unconditioned. So, another way to look at those four foundations of mindfulness. So I'm going to stop here for a minute for comments, questions, ideas about this, and have one more sort of teaching to article to talk about, present. But any reflections on all of that? Yeah, over here.
You have more. Oh, that's just like some of the most profound stuff I've ever heard in my life.
Okay.
And that's all.
Okay. All right. Back here, Gail, I think it is.
I'm in agreement with Sage, and I wonder if I could hear the author's name again.
Uh-huh.
And where that the source of the material, because I would access it if I could.
Yeah. So it's Bhante Gunaratana is the name of the author. So Gunaratana, Gunaratana. And the book is The Four Foundations of Mindfulness in Plain English.
Okay, I've captured that.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Any other questions, comments? Yeah, over here, Crystal.
My name's Crystal. I really liked how this version broke down the selfless piece. I feel like I sometimes kind of struggle with what that really means to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, when you broke it down in that reading, I was like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. I found it pretty useful too, which is why I wanted to include it in what we're doing here.
I kind of had a question, or it was regarding the fact that the fruition of this practice was pretty much the same no matter the length of the art, the two possible fruitions.
I'm not quite sure. I'm not sure I'm here understanding you quite.
Yeah. So whenever you talked about basically the length of time it takes to see the fruition of these practices,
the 7 years and the 5 years and the whatever.
Yeah. I just found it interesting that the time to go really actually didn't make much of a difference.
Uh-huh.
I just was wondering if you could maybe speak more to that.
Yeah. Well, this last Sunday, I believe we had a talk about time from Fish, and there's something in that where I think those of us who have been practicing for a long time have had this experience of, oh, now I get it. And then 6 months later saying, oh, now I really get it. And then a year later saying, oh, my goodness, right? So I think there's a way. I think what's being said here might have something to do with this enlightenment business is something that happens often, okay? And I've heard Shinyu talk about little e enlightenment and big E enlightenment, whatever. I don't know. You could talk about it in a lot of different ways. But the fact is, all we have is right here and right now. So this might be a half a month or a half a week or 7 years, right here. This is it. And the fact that I've been practicing 20 some odd years at this point, what does that mean? It doesn't mean much in this moment. It means a lot. It's a big deal. But in this moment, I'm practicing in this moment. That's it. So it has something that sort of gets to it a little bit. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, okay. It's hard to talk about, but, you know, time is kind of like that.
That's great, thank you.
At Minshew over here.
Hi, my name is Minshew. I think it also it also says to me something about achieving this kind of in our society.
About what? I'm sorry.
It also speaks to like this achieving kind of
achieving,
aspect,
yes.
Like having to, like we want to get something out of it.
Yes.
And I think being reminded that we're exactly where we need to be.
Yeah. That's true. That's part of it.
Thank you.
Kakamyo, did you have a comment? No. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm going to move on to one more thing that this is another great teaching that I have found incredibly useful that incorporates the four foundations of mindfulness. And this is the RAIN acronym. Many of you have heard me talk about this and other people as well. This says that it was articulated by Michelle McDonald. I first found this teaching from Jack Kornfield, who has it in a bunch of different places. So RAIN, R-A-I-N, is an acronym. And the first one, the R, stands for recognition. So they're saying it's the first step of mindfulness. When we're stuck in our life, we must begin with a willingness to see what is so. It is as if someone asks us gently, what's happening now? If we reply brusquely, nothing, or pause and acknowledge the reality, you know, do we do that? Or do we pause and acknowledge the reality of our experience here and now? I don't know about you, but I just recently noticed myself doing this kind of brushing away thing about whatever that was that just happened. It doesn't matter, you know, just sort of denying the whole thing. Recognition means, oh, I see it. I see it. With recognition, we step out of denial. Denial undermines our freedom. The diabetic who denies his body is not free. Neither is the driven, stressed out executive who denies the cost of her lifestyle, or the self-critical would-be painter who denies his love of making art. The society that denies its poverty and injustice has lost part of its freedom as well. If we deny our dissatisfaction, our anger, our pain, our ambition, we will suffer. If we deny our values, our beliefs, our longings, or our goodness, we will suffer. The emergence and blossoming of understanding, love, and intelligence has nothing to do with any outer tradition. It happens completely on its own when a human being questions, wonders, listens, and looks without getting stuck in fear. When self-concern is quiet in abeyance, heaven and earth are open. That's from Zen teacher Tony Packer. With recognition, our awareness becomes like a dignified host. We name and inwardly bow to our experience. Ah, sorrow. And now excitement. Yes, conflict. And yes, tension. Oh, now pain. Yes, and now, the judging mind. Okay. Recognition moves us from delusion and ignorance toward freedom. We can light a lamp in the darkness, says the Buddha. We can see what is so. I think Kyogen used to say something like recognition is, how does this go? Something, when you recognize a habit, its days are numbered. It's a step on the, it's a first step on the path. Now, mind you, that number might be kind of high, as many of us have found, but there is something about that that begins a path of forward. The next step of RAIN is acceptance. So the A of RAIN is acceptance. Acceptance allows us to relax and open to the facts before us. It is necessary because with recognition, there can come a subtle aversion, a resistance, a wish that it weren't so. Acceptance does not mean that we cannot work to improve things, but just now, this is what is so. In Zen, they say, if you understand, things are just as they are. And if you don't understand, things are still just as they are. Right? Acceptance is not passivity. It is a courageous step in the process of transformation. Acceptance is a willing movement of the heart to include whatever is before it. In individual transformation, we have to start with the reality of our own suffering. So first we have to recognize it, and then we have to accept it, really, truly accept it. For social transformation, we have to start with the reality of collective suffering, of injustice, racism, greed, and hate. We can only transform the world as we learn to transform ourselves. Carl Jung says, "Perhaps I myself am the enemy that must be loved." With acceptance and respect, problems that seem intractable often become workable. A man began to give large doses of cod liver oil to his Doberman because he had been told the stuff was good for dogs. Each day, he would hold the head of the protesting dog between his knees, force its jaws open, and pour the liquid down its throat. One day, the dog broke loose and the fish oil spilled on the floor. Then, to the man's great surprise, the dog returned to lick the puddle. That's when the man discovered that what the dog had been fighting was not the oil, but his lack of respect in administering it. With acceptance and respect, surprising transformations can occur. These two lead to the third step of RAIN, investigation. So the I, R-A-I, is investigation. Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh calls this seeing deeply. In recognition and acceptance, we recognize our dilemma and accept the truth of the whole situation. Now we must investigate more fully. Buddhism teaches that whenever we are stuck, it's because we have not looked deeply enough into the nature of experience. Buddhism systematically directs our investigation to four areas that are critical for understanding and freedom. See if you can guess what those four areas are. Yes? These are called the four foundations of mindfulness: body, feelings, mind, and dharma, the underlying principles of experience. Here's how we can apply them when working with a difficult experience. Starting with investigation in the body, we mindfully locate where our difficulties are held. Sometimes we find heat, contraction, hardness, or vibration. Sometimes we notice throbbing, numbness, a certain shape or color. We can investigate whether we are meeting this area with resistance or with mindfulness. We notice what happens as we hold these sensations with mindfulness. Do they open? Are there other layers? Is there a center? Do they intensify, move, expand, change, repeat, dissolve, transform? In the second foundation of mindfulness, we can investigate what feelings are a part of this difficulty. Is the primary feeling tone pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Are we meeting this feeling with mindfulness? And what are the secondary feelings associated with it? Sometimes we discover a constellation of feelings. A man remembering his divorce may feel sadness, anger, jealousy, loss, fear, and loneliness. A woman who is unable to help her addicted nephew can feel longing, aversion, guilt, desire, emptiness, and unworthiness. With mindfulness, each feeling is recognized and accepted. We investigate how each emotion feels, whether it is pleasant or painful, contracted or relaxed, tensed or sad. We notice where we feel the emotion in our body and what happens to it as it is held in mindfulness. Next comes the mind. What thoughts and images are associated with this difficulty? What stories, judgments, and beliefs are we holding? When we look more closely, we often discover that some of them are one-sided, fixed points of view, or outmoded, habitual perspectives. We see that they are only stories. They loosen their hold on us. We cling less to them. The fourth foundation to investigate is called mindfulness of the Dharma. Dharma is an important and multifaceted word that can mean the teachings and the path of Buddhism. It can mean the truth. This is where I get my what's really true here. And in this case, it can also mean the elements and patterns that make up experience. In mindfulness of the Dharma, we look into the principles and laws that are operating. We can notice if an experience is actually as solid as it appears. Is it unchanging or is it impermanent, moving, shifting, recreating itself? We notice if the difficulty expands or contracts the space in our mind, if it is in our control, or if it has its own life. We notice if it is self-constructed. We investigate whether we are clinging to it, resisting it, or simply letting it be. We see whether our relationship to it is a source of suffering or happiness. And finally, we notice how much we identify with it, which leads us to the last step of RAIN, non-identification. When I first encountered this teaching, I found recognition I had been doing a fair amount of, acceptance I had been working on, the four foundations of mindfulness. It wasn't the first time I had heard them, but it was pretty cool. Non-identification, I recognized this was a revelation for me. I had no idea how much I was identifying with a lot of this stuff. So I thought, okay, here's one for me to work on. It was really clearly that I recognized that. In non-identification, we stop taking the experience as me or mine. We see how our identification creates dependence, anxiety, and inauthenticity. In practicing non-identification, we inquire of every state, experience, and story, is this who we really are? We see the tentativeness of this identity. Instead of identification with this difficulty, we let go and rest in awareness itself. This is the culmination of releasing difficulty through RAIN. Buddhism calls non-identification the abode of the awakening, the end of clinging, true peace, nirvana. Without identification, we can live with care, yet we are no longer bound by the fears and illusions of the small sense of self. We see the secret beauty behind all that we meet. Mindfulness and fearless presence bring true protection. When we meet the world with recognition, acceptance, investigation, and non-identification, we discover that wherever we are, freedom is possible, just as the rain falls on and nurtures all things equally. So, I wanted to share all of this because these teachings have been very, very helpful for me in getting through a lot of stuff. And I was hoping that they could be useful for others as well. And they do relate to a lot of other teachings of Buddhism. So that's what I have. We have a few minutes left. If we have questions, comments, yeah, we go. Sage over here.
Sage, I want to understand more about non-identification.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's referring to specifically, because I guess not specifically, but like when I think about things, I do a lot of identifying them. Like I'll see an object or a situation or a feeling and I'll recognize a truth in it that I recognize as similar to a truth in something else. And mm-hmm. So I think in like metaphors, and that's how I identify things. And are you talking about that, or are you talking more about my making?
Yeah, it has to do with identifying who I am and you know, taking on something.
Okay. So
I'll give you an example where one of the first places I really recognized it in myself was when I went to Tassajara. I was just really overwhelmed because it was a brand new place. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know quite how things worked and all of that. And I started just really being terrified a lot. And at one point, and I started crying, you know, I was just like really having a hard time. And I finally went to a teacher and was talking about some of this. And I said, well, I guess I'm just going to be the monk who messes things up and cries a lot. So there's an identification right there, right? And it's a strategy, you know, it's just a strategy to try to like, it's a way to try to dismiss it, to say it's not a big deal or whatever. This is just who I am right now, right? And the teacher basically said to me, he looked at me and said, you can do that, or you can just do your best and see what happens. And I was like, really? You can do that? And I guess so. So that was sort of, for me, that was kind of the place where I could see this operating. But anytime you're doing that, anytime something comes up and you say, okay, and like I say, for me at that point, it was a strategy, but, and sometimes that's what it is. But sometimes it's just, you know, well, I'm the person who messes up, or I'm the type of person who, as soon as you have something like that going on, there's an identification going on there. And there's more to it too than that too, but that's an easy way for me to see that when that happens.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And over here.
Bridget, so when you're talking about awareness to view things, when you're viewing things with awareness, are you talking about awareness as the vibrational field of serving awareness itself, or what do you which layer is awareness?
Oh, that's a really good question. Because I think the way I've always thought about awareness is with the mind. I'm a delusion type. What can I tell you? So so when I see things, my awareness has to, oh my gosh, that's just amazing to me when I think about this. My awareness has often been to look at it, to observe it, to analyze it, to make comparisons, to evaluate it. For me, that's been awareness. So finding a way to be aware without doing that has been a big part of my practice, dropping judgment. So I don't know what I would say about vibrational field. For me, it's more like these four foundations have to do with mindfulness, have to do with awareness. So noticing where the body is, noticing, a lot of it's noticing, you know, and it has to do, and if you're feeling the body with the body,
yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And if you're feeling your feelings with the feelings, and if you're watching the mind with the mind, and if you're, you know, those are ways to think about awareness. So it's not all one thing.
Is the sensing the body with the body, is it the vibrational field of the life force observing the body, or which part of awareness would that be?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that I can actually answer that question. It's that question of the watcher or the observer. And I'm not quite sure how to say what that is.
I've never heard that before. Seeing the body with the body, and I feel there's so many layers to the body.
Yeah, and I think we experience it in our own way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Martha. I had a question, or actually, I guess it was just a statement. There were a couple things that you said, Ginkgo, that really struck me, and it's something I've been thinking about all week, and it was something connected to what Kakamiya talked about last week, which was, you know, you've talked a lot about this is not my feeling, it's selfless, and sort of non-identification with something as me or mine. And one of the things that really struck me last week, and I may be totally botching how this actually goes, but what I heard was, this is not me, this is not mine, I am not this.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines in what Kakamiya shared last time. And it just strikes me how this is all connected. It just seems like, I don't know whether I'm just hearing all of that because that's what's up for me right now, but it just seems really connected, and that's sort of the same theme.
Yes, and they are all connected. A lot. That's one of the great things about the Buddhist teachings is they all connect with each other, and you could hear echoes of a lot of other teachings in what I've been reading tonight. And we have to hear it over and over again from this point of view and from that point of view and with that angle and these words and those words and this translation. I mean, for me, that's what I'm finding, is that I've been, you know, at some point, you know, you can be hearing it forever and ever. Oh, God, this is one of the things that most teachers will tell you is, Kyogen used to say this, he'd say, I'd get this student who'd come back from a retreat from somewhere else and say, you know what this teacher said? Wow, this is really great. And Kyogen's like, I've been saying that for years, right? And many of us have had this experience, you know, parents have this experience. You know what Mary's mother said? And it was like, that's what I keep telling you. So I think it's true. They all connect, and they, you know, just like a slightly different emphasis maybe. It's true. It all happens in a bunch of different ways. The teachings in general, there's a way that we're finding, the latest scholarship is finding that they kind of all weave in and out of each other. So we can find new sutras, and there's very little that's actually new in them. They're just a different way of saying a lot of the same stuff that we see in a lot of other sutras. So that's one of the things that happens, I guess, in an oral tradition in any case, is that things overlap and then they get maybe reorganized, or maybe a little emphasis a little different, and that kind of thing. So I see that we are at right after 9 o'clock, so we can wrap this up. I thank you all for your kind attention, and I hope this has been helpful to you. And I believe we go into Vespers at this point, right?